Ben Bernanke faces his critics in Europe.
He says the Fed's $600 billion booster shot is good for everyone.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. Happy Friday, it's November 19th. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org.
Coming up, should airports ditch the TSA and go for private screeners because of those full-body scanners?
But first, in Germany today, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke defended the Fed's action to boost the U.S. economy. The Fed's recent decision to pump $600 billion more into the system has drawn fire from economic leaders around the world. Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard has the story for us from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So why is everyone so interested in what the Fed's going to do?
Well, to see if the Fed resorts once again to the ultimate weapon in its armory, printing more money to buy longer-dated U.S. government bonds. The Fed will be hoping to drive down long-term interest rates in this way so people borrow to buy houses and cars and companies expand. Now, economic recovery remains fragile in Britain and throughout Europe too, so central banks here may well be tempted to follow the Fed's example, says Ian Shepherdson of High Frequency Economics.
It certainly puts pressure on the Bank of England. And I would guess that within the next few months they will indeed follow, especially if it's deemed to be successful in the States, if it holds down those long-term interest rates, which is what they'd be targeting.
All right, Stephen, he mentions the Bank of England. What about other countries?
Well, the European Central Bank, which represents the 16 Eurozone countries, has been much more cautious about printing money than the Brits or the US. But one of the effects of the Fed doing this, if it works, would be to lower the value of the US dollar against the euro. Now, that would make it even tougher for European exporters to sell goods and services to the States. So the ECB may then come under pressure to protect European exporters and to follow the Fed's example as well and print more euros.
Marketplace is Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Now let's get another take on this with David Kelly. He's chief market strategist at JP Morgan Funds, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's listen quickly to some of what Chairman Bernanke had to say in Frankfurt this morning.
Insufficiently supportive policies in advanced economies could undermine the recovery not only in those economies, but for the world as a whole.
For the world as a whole. David Kelly, do you think the Europeans are buying that?
Not really. I mean, I think the Europeans would like to see a stronger U.S. economy, but not one that is stronger because of us getting more trade. Everybody's trying to get a low currency. Everybody wants to increase their exports. And the Fed's policy of a very expansionary monetary policy is pushing down the dollar. It's helping our exports, but it's hurting Europe's exports.
Do you think the Fed's policy is working the way Chairman Bernanke wants it to?
No, I don't think so. A lot of people worry about the inflationary effects of quantitative easing. But my real problem is that in order to sell this policy, he's really having to undermine confidence. And if you look at what he said in his speeches this morning in Europe, they really talk about the weakness of the economy, the potential for a relapse. And the problem is the American economy is not suffering from a lack of liquidity. It's suffering from a lack of confidence. It's kind of like if you've got a car and the spark plugs are shot, and you keep on flooding the engine with gasoline. And so I think the real problem is one of confidence, and the more the Federal Reserve tries to help the economy, the more it's actually undermining confidence.
Okay, David Kelly, Chief Market Strategist at JP Morgan Funds, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Municipal bonds are a pretty popular buy because they're tax-free. Many investors buy those bonds despite the fact that they have low interest rates. But a lot of bonds right now are from risky borrowers, such as the state of California, which is in a budget deficit crisis. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports other local governments held back selling their bonds when they realized there wasn't much demand.
Georgia's Gwinnett County is one of those governments. Maybe you remember Gwinnett as the home of the runaway bride of 2005.
Why would Jennifer Wilbanks take off just days before her wedding?
Investors know Gwinnett for its top-notch rating on sewer bonds. County Finance Director Aaron Bovos wanted to refinance those bonds this week in hopes of cutting utility bills.
If we can save money and if we can reduce rates, it's certainly our desire to do that.
But investors demanded higher interest payments. Marilyn Cohen of Envision Capital Management says one reason for that? Her home state of California has billions of dollars in debt hitting the market.
Oh, man, when you've got the 800-pound King Kong gorilla in the room, and that's California, we start to dwarf some of the more prudent states that don't issue as much.
Cohen says market indigestion will continue for munis through December. Gwinnett County says it will wait until next year to refinance. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
President Obama has a new budget director, well, new to President Obama anyway. Jacob Lew, who was confirmed by the Senate yesterday, served as budget director in the Clinton White House. But this time around, he'll have a $1.3 trillion deficit to contend with.
And Steve, we've been talking about a couple of deficit-cutting proposals that have come out since last week, one from the president's own deficit commission, the other from a bipartisan group in Washington. Well, Peter Coy has been digging into the details of both of them. He's the economics editor at Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, and he's with me here in New York. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we've got the Simpson-Bowles report, and we have the Bipartisan Policy Center report. We'll probably see some more reports. What are the major differences between these two?
If I had to point out the principal difference, it's that the Bipartisan Policy Center one, that's Alice Rivlin and Pete Domenici, emphasizes more the revenue side. They're the ones with this debt reduction sales tax, 6.5%. Both of them emphasize on the tax code trying to get rid of a lot of the deductions and credits and so on in order to broaden the base of income that gets subject to taxation.
Would both of these plans solve our debt problems?
On paper, yes, they would go a very long ways to solving it. But if you look closely, both of them are highly contingent on the assumption that past 2020, the government will somehow be able to get a handle on Medicare and Medicaid. If that doesn't happen, we're off to the races. The debt will just soar as a percentage of GDP. The Simpson-Bowles is especially weak on that. They just kind of wave their hands at the problem and assert that somehow medical spending will be brought down. The Domenici and Rivlin plan, I think, has a little more meat on the bones. It talks about the idea of almost converting Medicare into more of a healthcare 401k, more of a defined contribution plan instead of a defined benefit plan, where the government would limit how much it puts up.
Because Medicare and Medicaid add up to the biggest share of our budget. Right.
Yeah.
Now, there's a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll out this week that says that 70% of people are uncomfortable with making cuts to programs like Medicare, Social Security, and defense, even in order to balance the budget. How can they get these things done if nobody wants to do it?
America has to grow up. We've seen what happened to Greece, Ireland, Iceland, when they let their finances get out of control. The markets can turn very quickly from supportive to bond market vigilantes on the loose. Change the public's attitudes, then it will be possible for politicians to do the right thing.
We the people have to drive the bus here. Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, November 19th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Well, this morning in California, a federal judge will consider a motion by Toyota to dismiss hundreds of lawsuits filed against the company. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith is with me here in New York with more on this. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning.
So this has everything to do with that sudden acceleration problem that caused Toyota to recall millions of cars.
It does. And most of these suits are about why the cars accelerated. Toyota says the problem was floor mats sticking to the gas pedals. But these suits claim the problem is actually caused by electronic controls in the car. That could have huge financial implications for Toyota. Now, a government investigation didn't find any problems with the electrical systems, but the Los Angeles Times dug up some internal documents from Toyota. Those suggest the problem is an electronic one and that Toyota's known about it for years. So the judge has to consider all that. Meanwhile, Toyota is sort of just hoping the case will go away. Here's Hans Greimel, the Asia editor for Automotive News.
They've managed to contain it so far, so good. But as long as these questions about quality keep dragging out, the more damage it could do to their image.
And Stacey, how much has all this been affecting Toyota's bottom line?
Well, Toyota did just post a quarterly profit of more than $1 billion, but sales have been flat and Toyota has lost market share in the U.S. for the first time in more than a decade.
Okay. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith here in New York. Thanks.
Thank you.
A little less than a week before millions of U.S. passengers take to the skies for Thanksgiving, and controversy continues over hundreds of those full-body security scanners installed at more than 60 airports across the country, enough so that authorities and passengers are thinking about other methods. Marketplace's Eve Troe filed this report.
I haven't seen this much outrage ever.
George Hobica runs the website Airfare Watchdog. He's written about air travel for 15 years.
He says the scanners use radiation to see through your clothes. If you refuse them, you get an external pat-down. That could include your privates. Some passengers call that a deal-breaker.
People are sending us emails saying, you know, take me off of your email list for low airfares because I'm not flying anymore.
Republican Congressman John Mica wrote to 150 major airports urging them to ditch TSA and hire private contractors who wouldn't use the scanners to screen passengers. Steve Lott with the International Air Transport Association says some European countries and Dubai have suspended the use of scanners. He says there are smarter ways to collect passenger information.
You know, we really need to work towards increased intelligence at the checkpoint.
And that, Lott says, should begin well before passengers even arrive at the airport. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, grocery stores will be packed this weekend as people grab all the fixings for Thanksgiving. So what does all that eating and traveling and family visiting mean for the environment? We've called on Marketplace sustainability reporter Adrian Hill to help us figure it all out. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Steve.
So a big green thumbs up or green thumbs down on Thanksgiving?
You know, it would be super easy to apply the whole bummer environmental vibe to yet another American tradition.
Like a Debbie Downer.
But it's no fun. I don't want to be that reporter. Yes, the best thing you can do on Thanksgiving is to sit at home, alone in the dark, without any heat, don't eat anything. You'll save a ton of carbon that way. But I really like Thanksgiving. So instead, I want to focus on how you can make the holiday more environmentally friendly.
And?
Well, one of the most significant environmental impacts is all the travel. A lot of us, myself included, are going to go to the airport and fly long distances to be with people we care about. And there's not much you can do to make that flying much more efficient. But when you are packed into the middle seat and jammed up with no leg room and a crying baby on one side, just know that your flight's very efficient when it's all packed full like that and feel a little better about it.
A full flight is better than an empty one.
It is. If you're driving, it would help to get your car tuned up and your tire pressure checked before you go. That'd save on gas costs. And you might consider carpooling with dear Aunt Mildred.
Oh, Aunt Mildred. She's nice. All right, what about the Thanksgiving meal?
Well, turkey in the scheme of things is not a bad choice. It takes a lot less fuel to make a turkey than a lamb or a cow. So keep the turkey and maybe ditch the roast beef. Of course, if you're that kind of guy, Steve, you could consider a veggie holiday if you're really serious about reducing your environmental impact.
No. I'm just going to feel good about not eating beef. How about that?
Good for you. Fair enough. There's another way to make the holiday more sustainable without abandoning your family or your traditions.
All right. What's that?
Just don't waste as much food. Cook fewer pies, or better yet, invite more people over to eat them. Over the course of the year, Americans throw out about a quarter of their food. They're wasting all the energy it takes to make and cook that food. By wasting less food, you'll waste less energy. And then you get to eat all those delicious leftovers.
Oh, yeah, the leftovers. I love that. Mm. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Steve.
And finally, Steve, the precursor to Facebook has sold at auction for about $30,000, which doesn't seem like very much in Silicon Valley terms these days. The website is called Face Mash, and it was put together in 2003 by the founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. Now, Face Mash, when it started, only had 450 users, which is about how many friends I feel like most people have on Facebook these days.
Pretty much. Absolutely.
Facebook has, what, a half a billion users or something like that.
I was not a part of the inaugural Face Mash, no.
You were not in Face Mash. I wasn't in Face Mash either, but we're both on Twitter, and you have a new handle, as they say.
I do. It's at, a little at symbol, Radio Chio.
Radio Chio. And I am at Jeremy Hobson, and that is my name, and I'm in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.